Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We live in tumultuous times. Headlines about climate change and political turmoil greet us every day. On this show, we'll hear from two women who are responding creatively to dire news.
I think we're inundated with images in the media that have to do with fires in Sonoma and melting permafrost. And it actually doesn't work. We don't see it anymore because we're numb to those images.
Multimedia artist Brenda Slamani discusses the portraits and stories of those grappling with climate change. And Elizabeth Alexander is a political geographer whose research led her to podcast about the effort to recall Governor Dunleavy.
People are being hurt. The stories from the Pioneers home, from daycare, from the arts. And so what I wanted to do with the podcast is let people actually hear the voices of people who either support the recall or themselves have been impacted by the governor's actions.
I hope you'll stick around. Noted New York-based painter Brenda Slamani visited Alaska this summer. She was tapped to be the artist in residence at Denali National Park. But she was less interested in the landscape than in the people living on the land. Indeed, Slamani visited several communities in Alaska, including Utqiagvik, as part of a larger project to capture the images and stories of those impacted by climate change. As you'll hear in my discussion with her this summer, she not only paints her subjects, but records the process with her smartphone.
When I was painting portraits, I started noticing that the conversations, like the things people would tell me when I painted them, was really interesting. It wasn't like the stuff you normally got in a conversation. It would be more like what you would get in therapy or in confession, if you've ever been to confession. And so I started recording the conversations and videotaping the conversations to save them because it was just so interesting how the intimacy of the portrait process led to conversations you normally don't have. And then I started making films out of the conversations because now the portraits are part of it and I want them to be as good as possible, but the portraits are also like a means to another end.
And what is that end?
Now what I do is I'll set a project, like this one is Climate in America, and it's taking place in Key West, Florida, Sonoma, California, Alaska, Utqiagvik, and in Denali, and then in Glacier National Park in Montana. And in this project, I'll paint the portraits. I'm trying to focus on people and their relationship to climate change. You know, like in Sonoma, there were the fires, so I worked with people in Coffee Park. And so I'm trying to steer the conversations toward that direction, but anything can happen. And so the final show will be the portraits, a documentary film, various kinds of photography, and then possible paintings that I make at home. So once I get home with hundreds of portraits, hours and hours of footage, then I start to shape an exhibition. And it could have, you know, large blown up slides with music. It can be any number of things because that I've got my materials and I'm beginning to shape.
I'm going to circle back to this current project, but when did you first realize you loved art?
Well, I mean, it's a story that I can tell you really simply. So I went to Catholic school, and I'm left-handed, and I'm a mirror writer. So you know what that is, right? I write backwards.
Backwards, yeah.
And so I was not
like Leonardo da Vinci. He's the only other artist I know who did that.
Yeah. And so you could imagine I was not a favorite of the nuns. In those days, left-handers were not in favor in those days, and I had to sit on it. And so when I was six, the nuns asked me what I wanted to be, and I said I wanted to be a nun. And they said, you could not because you're left-handed. And then I said, how about an astronaut? Because we had just put someone on the moon. And they said, no, you can't because you're a girl. And I said, well, what about a painter? And they said, yes, you can do that. So it was a third choice career when I was six.
And you never kind of deviated. That's a remarkable thing for somebody so young to hit upon something they knew they wanted to do.
Yeah, but
besides the astronaut.
But it wasn't obviously my first choice.
Yeah, yeah, obviously.
But I think there's many aspects of it of why I wanted to do that so soon. One was that I couldn't read and write until much. I mean, I'm not really a good reading writing person. I mean, I've had some therapy with mirrors, but it's not easy for me to read and write. And so academics don't come easily to me. And I think when you are an outsider as a kid, when you have like a learning disability, you become a keen observer of everybody else. And I think that's something that's needed for portraiture. I was just enough of an outsider that I was watching everyone all the time and observing and drawing. And I didn't see myself as part of things because I couldn't fit in.
You know, I was thinking about this, Brenda, in a different context, about how we value so much rational thought, but intuition and emotions are so powerful, and we seem to discount that in our culture. In a funny way, do you think not being a strong reader or writer gives you special insights?
I think so. And I think, I think one of the problems, this is another conversation, but I think one of the problems now is we're trying to homogenize kids by drugging them if they don't fit in, you know. And I think actually the thing that I am happy about is they didn't try to correct me. I was just the outsider who, you know, who was Sinestra, you know, and had something that made me not part of things. And then I was free to develop my own way of seeing.
Yeah. So as you matured, how did you hit upon these kind of projects in order to express yourself? Why not landscapes? I would have thought approaching these communities and places through landscape would be an obvious choice, but you chose portraits.
I've always been really interested in people. I'm not that interested in landscape. And actually getting back to the project in Alaska, I'm surprised they picked me because it's a competitive program, the artist residency in Denali, and I wrote a proposal saying that I'm not interested in landscape, I'm interested in people who work in the landscape. And I didn't think they would go for that, and I guess they get so many landscape artists that they were interested in what a portraitist would do there. And then, of course, once I got it, I had to come, which was terrifying because of all the landscape and animals and stuff, all that other stuff that is not people.
That's right. It's an interesting project. There is a quality about scientists that now so much when they go into a village to document climate change, the people in that, A, help with it, and all the findings from that research are given back to the people. In what way do you want to give your work back to the people of Alaska when you finish your work here, Brenda?
Actually, in my contract with Denali, I will give them something back. They want something digital. So I think I'll try to make maybe a digital sketchbook where some of the stories come out. It's interesting what you said about the scientists giving back to the communities, because I was asking the people in Utqiagvik, the people who live there, how do they feel about all these scientists? And they said the relationship is good and they're getting something back. I mean, I'm interviewing enough scientists so that whatever they give me is information that could be used.
Yeah.
But you could say Alaska's the poster child, but what about Sonoma, California, like Coffee Park or Paradise? I'm not singling out Alaska. What I'm doing is traveling around America, and so it's either hurricanes or fires or permafrost. I mean, we're all in this together. So what I'm really trying to do is create a community in the country, so it's not Alaska under the microscope, but it's all of these places have something in common, which is they're experiencing in real life, in their real day-to-day life, whether you lost your house or any number of things, we're all in this together and it is a real thing. People's lives are changing. Is that something that's going to be okay? Is there anything we can do differently? Mm. I find different things in different places. Like in Key West, the big problem is people don't want to talk about climate change because the homes are really valuable. And if you start talking about climate change, the real estate is going to plummet. So you can't. And in Sonoma, a lot of the houses are being rebuilt in exactly the same places. And so they'll just burn again because those fires are going to happen again and again and again. But the insurance companies are not making it possible for people to move. So, I mean, even New York City, we had Hurricane Sandy and, you know, certain parts of New York in the A zone are, that's the
flood zone. Is that where you live?
No, I'm in a B zone.
In the B zone?
Yes, so I'm better off.
Phew.
Phew, I'm in the B zone.
Dodge that bullet.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Northern Soundings, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with multimedia artist Brenda Zlamani about her project to capture the images and stories of people impacted by climate change. When we return, shared intimacies. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. I'm speaking with Brenda Zlamani, a noted portraitist who has a project to capture the images and stories of people on the cutting edge of climate change. Zlamani was artist in residence at Denali National Park this summer. Let's get back to our discussion.
Do you find your conversations during the painting of these people gives you a better grasp of their personalities?
Yes. I think for me, maybe the portraiture is communication. It's a kind of intimacy that isn't really possible with strangers. You get to stare. They get to stare at you. I work with the sketchbook flat so they can see the image of themselves coming up. So they see me seeing them. And sometimes there'll be situations where I'll play with it. If somebody is uncomfortable, like maybe they have three chins all put in two. Or sometimes somebody will, I was painting Annie Dillard, the writer, and she was not behaving at all. Like she wanted to draw me and she was like all over the map. And then she said, oh, I don't want to have a double chin. And I said, you know, I'm going to give you a triple chin if you don't sit still. So it's kind of, I think I feel empowered as the artist. I guess you could say I'm the puppet master in the conversation. Maybe that's why I like it, which is a terrible thing to say, isn't it?
No, it isn't. When I interview people, and in fact, when I ask people about their lives, very often they'll open up because nobody really asks them about where did you come from and why this thing. Suddenly, to have some, you know, in a social context, actually somebody ask other than the weather or the politics of the thing. And I understand entirely what you experienced.
Brenda. Yeah, you're right. So you're on board and you understand because there is some, you. If I'm painting you, I can ask you anything.
Why?
Because I'm painting you and I'm trying to get information for the portrait. I'm trying to, you want to show yourself to me because I am your portraitist. I'm portraying you and I'm in charge of your immortality. And so you're trying to give me as much as you can, and I can go, and I could push as hard as I want. And also, I can look down at the brush and say something very, very, I could ask you a question that's very personal, and then move on easily, because I'm just exploring and painting. I can't explain it, but it puts me in a place where anything is possible.
That's a pretty cool place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel that way when you're, as an interviewer, you've got your headphones and do you feel, is it like a brush for you where you feel?
You know, not so much. I think for me, I think every person is such a rich stew of elements.
Uh-huh.
And that allowing some of those elements that don't come out so often
mm-hmm.
or to reflect on deeper issues. For example, I want to know what your portraits say about you. Now, if I had just met you, Brenda, I wouldn't ask you that necessarily. But because you're in this dynamic situation, like we're talking about, I feel like I can. And you will say, well, I don't really want to talk about it. It's not about me. Or you could say, well, you know, that's funny. I blah, 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 blah. And you can go on.
Right. But you know what's really weird is no one's ever asked me that before. And so I haven't actually come up with an answer off the top of my head. I mean, I'm addicted to it. It's like I'm a vampire. Like, when I get in a project like this, it's just so exciting. And it's communication for me. I'm really solitary when I'm not painting, actually. I mean, for me, it's social. It's art. I want the paintings to look good. I mean, obviously, I want a product. But the journey is just as important for me. It's about getting to know people. Where we go, I just sat down with a scientist this morning, and I wasn't sure where it was going to go, where we would end up. the whole process. I don't control how it's going to look. And I mean, I try to control it. And it just ended really well with a hug. And she gave me some sunglasses as a gift. And it was just this journey we went on. It was very intense. And I love it. I can't explain how fun it is and how exciting and how risky it is. Like every single time I set out to paint someone, I am scared to death that I'm not going to pull it off.
Let's talk then about the aims of this. Do you think these opportunities, people reveal their relationships with their place through this exchange you have?
Yeah, I do. What I think, if this project succeeds, I think the way it will succeed in terms of the public and in terms of what I can bring back is I think we're inundated with images in the media that have to do with fires in Sonoma and melting permafrost. And it actually doesn't work. We don't see it anymore because we're numb to those images. And I think people don't really listen to scientists either because they're just not popular in America, right? But I think me sitting down with individuals, having them talk, because there's film also, and just like this kid in Utqiagvik telling me about how hard whaling is with the melting ice because you have to pull it in. So I actually have these kinds of human stories where people are just talking. They're not trying to convince you. They have no agenda. A woman telling me about after the fires in Sonoma, finding her parents. One of them was dead in the car, and the other one had obviously tried to make it down the hill, and her obsession with what did they feel at the end of their lives. And then having people say, like, you know, like an older guy I painted in Sonoma who was like 100, who said, well, these fires have always happened. So I don't have an agenda. I'm just gathering these stories. And so the viewer will be at the cocktail conversation hearing these stories. And I think this is a more human thing that may speak to the viewer more than news images or data. So I was in Key West where they had a lot of hurricanes. So I was working with people who experienced the hurricanes. I think if the project succeeds, it will make people feel closer to situations. Just to give you some background, I started the project in 2011. So it's been going on for a long time. It's called The Itinerant Portraitist. And each time I pick a population or a topic and I pick a number of portraits that's related to some aspect of the project. So the one that I started in 2011 was called 888. It was in Taiwan, and I was painting Taiwanese Aboriginal people. In Chinese culture, 8 means money, so it was money, money, money. So everybody wanted to be painted, and I went to all these Aboriginal villages, 33 different villages, and painted people. And then it was shown in Taipei, and most Taiwanese who are Han don't really pay attention to Aboriginal culture. So it actually was a really interesting and important project for bringing the cultures together. And then I showed it in New York also, and it had 2 movies, it had a sound room, and it was really exciting. And that was 2011. And then in 2016, I went back to all the same villages to see how they were doing, because my daughter did a project there. And it created real friendships, real relationships, and I think positive results. The most recent one that was completed was called 100 out of 100. And those were mostly people close to 100. I painted 100 of them. And I spent the summer in a nursing home painting people who were older and close to death, sometimes dying, and hearing their stories. And it was wonderful. Just these are people who are tucked away that we don't see. People are afraid to look at old people. They're afraid of aging. And I found so much joy and so much of interest. So the show's traveling now. The film is going to film festivals. And I think it's very positive.
You mentioned these narratives and stories these people give you. Is that why you videotape as well as paint in order to capture some of their stories to go along with the images?
Yeah. Originally, it was a painting project. And I started discovering that people were telling me secrets, even. Like, I painted this one collector once. I did a year of people in the art world, one a day. And this woman who was 84 came to my studio and she said, I have been cheating on my husband for 40 years with this guy. And then he got Alzheimer's disease, and now he no longer remembers me. and my husband never found out, and now I'm in love with my husband again. And then she said, I don't know why I told you that. I've never told anyone. And then a light bulb went off that, like, people are telling me things they've never told anyone. And so I started asking people if I could record the conversations. Previously, I had just taken notes, and then I would add the note. I would add the content myself after, based on the conversations. So then I started filming them, and people quickly forget. I film on an iPhone.
Oh, really?
But I do I mic with lavalier mics, so the sound is good. But I'm on an iPhone, so it's very easy to forget. There's no film crew, and it's not intrusive.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with noted portraitist and multimedia artist Brenda Zlamani. We'll return to our conversation following this short break. You're listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. I'm talking with Brenda Zlamani, painter and multimedia artist. She was tapped as Denali National Park's Artist in Residence this summer. Let's get back to our discussion.
What's your medium when you're painting? Do you prefer
watercolor?
Watercolor. What does watercolor provide you? Let's say pastels wouldn't, or oils.
Well, watercolor is a completely unforgiving medium because it's transparent, so you can't cover up. So it forces you to see well and quickly and definitely. Whereas in oil painting, you can sort of you can back up, go forward. That's the joy of oil painting, is developing the image slowly. This forces me to be at my very best. And watercolor requires that kind of secure seeing because it's not really a portrait medium. And there are no rejects in my project. So if you're in, no matter how bad it is,
or how many chins I have.
Yeah. But actually, getting back to the older people, I just want to put this out there. Like, when I first started painting, I was like, how am I going to do this? There were a lot of chins. There were breathing tubes, drool, you name it, it was there. And so I was starting to try to flatter people a little because it was pretty intense. And then it occurred to me that they didn't want to be flattered. Actually, my daughter came in and said, Mom, don't flatter them. You're not getting paid. So I decided not to flatter them. And then I found that they preferred that. They wanted to see me seeing them as they were and accepting them and caring about them. I mean, usually the portrait sessions end in a hug or sometimes crying even. People sometimes feel like they've been seen for the first time. So it was very emotional, especially in the nursing home. But it was interesting to know there's a point where people don't want to be flattered. They want to see you seeing their reality. What is the definition of love? I'm not really sure, but I think it has something to do with feeling like you're seen.
Well, I'm sure that's one element of it.
Yeah.
When you position your subjects, is it face on? Do you prefer being slightly to the side? How do you go about deciding how to represent them?
Well, if somebody says they have a good side, I will go. Like, sometimes I'll say to someone, do you think you have a good side? But I find that if I don't, like, I was painting the portraitist Alex Katz, and he said, oh, paint me from sideways. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And then he wanted to look at me painting. So then he's not holding the pose because he has to look at me. So I'll say to someone, if someone says I have a good side and I want to be sideways, or sometimes someone will have a great profile, but I'll say, if I paint you this way, you're not going to get to watch the process. So how will you feel about not getting to watch? Because it's a trade-off.
What do most people choose?
Most people choose to watch.
Interesting.
It's really hard not to.
Yeah. And how is your technique developed, do you think, Brenda?
Well, I've probably done about 3,000 watercolor portraits. Before I got the Fulbright to Taiwan in 2011, I had never done a watercolor in my life. I just decided that would be part of my project. So my project was exploring this population, and I was going to use this medium. And now I pretty much can control it. But when people ask me, like when I'm teaching and people say, well, so how did you learn how to do it? Really, it's just like if you do something and it looks good, do it again. If you don't like it, don't do it again. Like that's all you need to know. Like do it, look at it, and decide if it was good or bad. And when you've done like 3,000 watercolor portraits, you have had a lot of good or bad to know which things look good.
Yeah, I think there's something magical about having a human hand suddenly materialize you on the page, don't you think?
Yeah, but what you're seeing is you're seeing someone see you.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think it's a myth. People think that photography is a truth medium. Like if I take a picture of you, that is how you look. When actually it couldn't be further from the truth because we never see people, we rarely see people not moving. And so what a photo captures is the opposite of life. But when you're painting someone and they're moving, you're actually capturing something that is more real. If I was painting you, I would be combining, like you're doing a thoughtful sort of look right now, but then you have a nice smile. So I might take the thoughtful on the top and the smile on the bottom. And when I walk away from hanging around with you, I'll mix all those my memory of you will not be a single photographic face. It'll be a bunch of different expressions that I reconfigure in my mind. So in a way, the portrait that I paint is more real than the photograph, even though it may not look like photographic reality, which is not reality.
Mm. You know, there was a psychological study that they did, and that they asked grad students, and poor grad students, I'm telling you, they have to go through hell. But some people could, they were asked to poke the eyes out of images of people. And a certain percent, I can't remember what the percentage, but they couldn't bring themselves to do that. Because defacing this piece of paper was, in some emotional sense, harming the person behind that image.
Yeah.
Do you think why you're attracted to portraits is that sort of magical thing we have with the human face?
I think so. I think you're onto something. I mean, sometimes when I'm painting, I don't feel that I exist. I feel like I'm like a lightning rod and I'm taking things out. I'm putting it onto the page. I don't know if this project is going to be successful. I won't know until I put it out there and see how people respond to it. But I feel that the gathering phase that I'm in now is successful. People in Alaska are really generous with their stories. The faces are great. Visually, they're great. The stories are amazing. They're so different than what we have in New York, so different than Florida. Can I shape it into something that is useful? My biggest concern is always to present people in the most dignified and respectable way. So I'm not worried about, I would never do anything negative in a project. That's at the bottom of my project, is I am looking for information and I'm not looking to hurt anybody. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. Yeah, sure.
Do you know who John Singer Sargent is?
Yes,
okay, good. Well, he used to paint his friends, like opera singers singing, because he felt, not his commissioned portraits, but his portraits of his friends involved people being active. And there's something about the active person in a conversation. But one of the things that's hardest is if I'm painting a complete stranger, in the hour that I get to know them, they might transform into something else. And I'll start out with one thing, and then suddenly at the very end of the conversation, they show me the real self. And then I'm like scrambling to see, can I get that expression onto the face as well? So that's the challenge, is it's an active process where I'm trying to get at them and I'm hoping they're going to give it to me and then I'm going to see it before I hit the end, because watercolor doesn't let you go backwards. So it's a very exciting thing to do.
You're listening to Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with multimedia artist Brenda Zlamani about her project to capture the images and stories of people impacted by climate change. When we return from the break, the truthfulness in images. back. This is Northern Soundings. I'm speaking with Brenda Zlamani, a noted portraitist who has a project to capture the images and stories of people on the cutting edge of climate change. Zlamani was artist in residence at Denali National Park this summer. Let's get back to the discussion.
What happens when the project concludes? Do you have file cabinets full of portraits that you save?
I have other work. I do oil paintings, and that's what I'm mostly known for in my career, and that's how I earn a living, big commission projects and exhibitions of oil paints. So what I do with these portraits is I don't sell them. So, yeah, I have thousands of them. And what do I imagine is going to happen? I mean, I've got taxi cab drivers in Cuba. I just spent a month in Saudi Arabia painting people at Camel Festival. I just imagine an exhibition with like thousands and thousands of faces. I can't really part with them.
And do you ever go back and look at them again?
Yeah, I do all the time. And once I paint someone, I feel very close. It's very intimate. On my last night at Denali, I was in a room with a bunch of park rangers and interpretive rangers, and I had painted half the people in the room, and they were my people. I felt at home. I felt it was my family. It's a closeness. It's terrible when someone changes, when they gain weight or lose weight or change their hairstyle, because the moment that I paint them in is my greatest reality of them. I prefer if they stay true to that.
So interesting, because having done the work with people in a nursing home, life's so transient. And now that I'm in my 60s, I'll look at myself in the mirror some mornings and I think, who the hell is that? And so it's interesting to hear that the portraitist feels the same way about that person, that image that you created, that you don't want them to change either. You've got them here.
Yeah, but I had an interesting instance in yesterday's class that I taught at Denali. There was a father and daughter, and they painted each other, and she painted him looking significantly younger, and everybody in the class, we had a crit, said she made him look younger. And I said, well, you know, when you paint someone, you're balancing what you see, what you know, what you wish was true, what you think is true, and she's painting her father, and she's thinking of him when she was 2 years old, looking at him, and he was reading. Like, it was a beautiful painting, but it was not a man in his 60s. But it was her reality of what she thinks of when she thinks of her dad. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think it was in the nursing home. It is strange to suddenly wake up, and you're not in the body that you identify yourself in. That is of... It's a crazy thing. And I think that was one of the reasons they wanted me to paint them as they were. They wanted to see it too. And they didn't want to see what was in the mirror. They wanted to see it through me. They wanted me to filter it.
And they got that piece.
And they got that. And I think that was useful to them. I think it's so complicated.
Totally complicated.
Everything about image. Like, did you know like the Egyptian mummy paint, the Fayum paintings that... They were painted, those are the ones that go on your, when they bury you on your in your sarcophagus.
Some of the most sophisticated portraits I found is from like the 2nd century AD Egypt.
They're great.
Yeah, those funereal images.
Right, but they were painted when you were alive, and then you were buried with it later. So what's that about?
I don't know, but it's great.
Yeah.
Who did the best portrait of you?
In my life, so I've been painted by David Hockney, and I still don't look that old, and he painted me in the 80s, but it's a very, very good portrait. I've been painted by Alex Katz, and that was quite a good one. I've done numerous self-portraits.
Like Rembrandt.
Yeah, but this is the thing. Like, I think as a woman artist, it's harder to, I mean, it's a construct. How, like, when I'm painting myself, I'm in control. And so I have to decide, and I think of those paintings by like male artists like Otto Dix with a cigar and stuff, and I want to look like those guys. And when I look in the mirror, it's hard for me to fashion myself into the artist. When I think of myself as an artist, I think of myself as a male portraitist more than a female.
Interesting.
So I've done lots. I'm always, when I'm painting myself, I'm trying to figure out how do I want to be seen.
But it's interesting when I asked you, who did the best one? You mentioned famous painters. Was there a not-so-famous painter that tackled you that you thought they captured something that maybe a more accomplished painter wouldn't have?
No, I don't think so. I think David Hockney's images of me are really, really good.
Are they?
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's a terrific.
He's the best.
Yeah,
he's painted my daughter. So I posed for him. He's painted my family. I've painted him. He is the master of seeing people.
Really? What's his personality like? When you painted him, did you see an aspect of him that you didn't see or know through his works?
Not really, because I know him outside of his work. He's a very different kind of person to model for than I am. He does not talk when he paints you, and he stares at you in a way that makes you feel like he's reading your mind. It's very intense.
No,
pose for him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I
do you pick up
terrifying.
Pointers when? Did you ever pick up a pointer like, oh, I got to adapt that look? That's a good look.
No, but I mean, there aren't that many portraitists. I mean, there's more now than there used to be when I was coming up because when I was coming up as an artist, it was during minimalism and feminism. So, and portraiture was the white male language and you weren't supposed to do it. So now it's more in fashion. But it wasn't then. And so really all there was Chuck Close, Alex Katz, David Hockney, Alice Neal, who really didn't become well known until she was dead.
What's the gestation period then for you, Brenda? Once you've gone out in the field, gathered all this material, how long does it take you to kind of synthesize and work through
it? I think
it'll
take about a year because I've got to go through, I have hundreds of hours of interviews. I have to raise some funding for editing because film stuff is expensive, much more expensive than painting, which is just hair on a stick that you're waving pigment around. So I'm going to have to pull together some funding for editing. Once I start to visually see what it looks like, I have to sort out what kind of venue it would make sense in. Like Key West, I showed in Key West separately because they wanted it. So I've taken the project apart and can show those elements separately, like each of the places, but I want to bring it together. Maybe there'll be four big, large-scale paintings, like the Four Seasons, because each place is almost like a different season that might actually round off an exhibition.
So the creativity continues after you've done all this work out in the field.
This is just the research.
This is just the tip of the...
It's the research.
Iceberg, so to speak.
Yeah, it's the research phase. But it's been great being in Alaska. People have been honest. They've been generous with their time.
Mm.
It's been really, really interesting. And the people in Alaska look so different than... There's so many men, first of all. And there's so much facial hair on the men. So even if there was no movie and you hung the Key West portraits... And the Key West is going to be a lot of older women in tie-dyed outfits. And then you've got these Alaska macho men with facial hair. And everybody, California looks a certain way. So even without the video, the portraits are telling the story.
Well, what a pleasure to meet you and talk with you.
Yeah, this is really fun.
Links to Brenda Zlamani's webpage are on the Northern Soundings website. When we return from the break, voicing concerns about Governor Dunleavy. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. As many Alaskans know, there is a drive to recall Governor Mike Dunleavy. The effort was a response to the governor's actions, including his budget, which deeply slashed programs including the Marine Highway System, education, and senior benefits. The first phase of the recall effort this summer gathered an overwhelming number of signatures. But the effort is now in the courts when the Division of Elections rejected the recall application on the opinion of Attorney General Kevin Clarkson. Clarkson says the application's grounds were legally insufficient. Recall supporters are seeking that decision to be overturned. But not all responses to the recall effort are legal at this point. Elizabeth Alexander has a doctorate in political geography. As you'll hear, she felt it was critical to hear from Alaskans impacted by the governor's actions. She decided to protest through podcasting. Here's an excerpt of her inaugural episode.
Recently, I spoke with three Fairbanksans to get their thoughts on the recall.
I'm Mike West. I live in Fairbanks, family here in town with three school-age kids. I work at the university in earthquake science.
My name is Lucy Evans, and I am from Colombia. I moved to Alaska in 1977. I came here looking for work and also because I heard that Alaska was very beautiful. My heart is divided. One part is for me to take care of my business and my clients as a hairdresser, and the other part, which I live at night, is to become a writer full-time one day.
I'm the Reverend Leslie Ahuva Fales, and I'm the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Fairbanks. And I serve a congregation of about 108 people here in the Golden Heart City.
Like everyone I've talked to about the recall, they each have their own reasons, but they're very united on one thing. The governor's behavior and his actions are not what Alaska is all about.
To be an Alaskan for me is to be here to take care of ourselves, first of all, because the weather is pretty brutal, so the community has to be pretty close together. We're like a big family, and then have the opportunity to make this beautiful place no more beautiful, because it's already beautiful, but to preserve what we have, because we live in a paradise, really.
What about the state differentiates it from anywhere else that I've ever lived is how people here take care of one another. That is like part of the core ethos of what it means to be an Alaskan. And it's something that nobody tells you. You know, it's something that you feel as soon as you start to integrate into this community, that people will bring you food when you're sick, or they will help you when you're trying to find a place to live, or you know, the way that people potluck to support one another when there's a need or an illness or a death. You know, someone's roof is caving in on their, you know, very Alaskan home that they have, and people are just going to go out there and help replace his roof. It's a beautiful thing that people just naturally do here. Doesn't matter what political stickers are on your car. You know, at 30 below, we're all family.
Living in Alaska has been everything that I anticipated and more. It's been a spectacular place to raise a family. My kids are tough and capable, all sorts of things that they don't even really know, because they don't have any other perspective. That's just how they are. I don't take all the credit for that. I really honestly believe that the community here and the lifestyle has just had a profound influence on them and our family.
Each of us has our own reasons for signing the recall. I wondered what theirs are.
I did sign the recall, and the reason for that is not so much that I disagree with a decision or two from what I see out of our administration, but the way that it's being conducted does not agree with my view of what executive branch leadership should look like. When a senior administrator goes before the legislature and states that we're proposing the following action, and no, we have not examined the consequences, it just has to happen, that's not acceptable to me.
I sign it because I always believe that bad things happen fast, and good things, to create good things, it takes time. And I believe that a leader did things too fast, and I wanted a leader who makes a decision based on work that he did personally to understand what is going on. We don't make changes based on a moment without thinking about it. I understand that sometimes we need to cut things, you know, because maybe things are not as organized as they can be. But I do believe that you don't go there and cut so much in one time, you know, it's like cutting half of the body. This is a metaphor, but cutting like somebody's body in half, and then you're only going to leave part of the body try to function. It doesn't work that way, you know. We have to do things systematically.
I have signed the recall petition. I was there the day that it started at Pioneer Park, and I got there about 20 minutes after they started, and I was just overjoyed to see all the people there, people that I didn't recognize. I waited for about 5 minutes because it was a very well-oiled machine. I actually didn't even have to get to the front of the line. Somebody came with a petition halfway through the line and was like walking with people and like helping them get through. So another one of our principles as Unitarians is belief and participation in the democratic process. I will never tell my people whom to vote for or not to vote for. That is not an ethical thing for me to do. But when someone is using their power at the highest levels to wreak suffering and death, and this will cause the deaths of some people, I have no choice but to stand up and say that we will use every tool within the arsenal of our body politic, which in this case is participating in the recall effort.
You just heard an excerpt of a fledgling podcast targeting the recall effort of Governor Mike Dunleavy. The creator and producer, Elizabeth Alexander, says beyond the legal, economic, and political issues involved, people's lives are at stake.
I chose to do a podcast because I think it's voices that is most important in this recall, particularly in these periods when the activity of gathering signatures and, you know, going through the longer process is it may feel like a lull out there, but actually it's not, because while all that work is going on, people are being hurt. The stories from the Pioneers Home, from daycare, from the arts, even those institutions who did get funding in the end brought back to some degree, are in a pretty high degree of trouble. And so what I wanted to do with the podcast is let people actually hear the voices of people who either support the recall or themselves have been impacted by the governor's actions.
Now, had you ever done anything with podcasting before this?
Not with podcasting per se, but as part of my graduate work, I did do recording both video and audio. I did a master's degree in geopolitics and security as a lead up to my PhD work. And as part of that, I researched the Scottish referendum, the independence referendum. And I spent about 2 months up in Scotland interviewing people, both in formal ways and informal ways, in coffee shops, but also prearranged gatherings. And those I often recorded or videotaped for future use in my analysis. So they weren't publicly presented as a final product, but they were absolutely integral to what I was doing. So I had some familiarity with the equipment, and also how powerful it is to actually hear people's voices as opposed to a written word, for example.
Now, it's interesting. You went in to secure your doctorate in political geography, but you worked for the software industry before that. Why did you leave that, and what drew you to that?
So software was an absolutely exciting place to be, but after 15 years in that industry, I realized that I didn't feel, for me, that I was producing anything of lasting benefit. It's such a high turnover kind of industry. I was a product manager, so I defined what kind of software we needed to build, and then I would test it and make sure that it was working for customers or a partner channel. But the turnover is so fast that a lot of times the work you do just kind of disappears very quickly into the ether. You know the rate of change in software. We've all experienced it. I wanted to do something that made more of a contribution, and I also really wanted to take time to think through and understand the problems that I saw as really pressing. The things that matter in the world, I didn't feel like I was having an understanding, much less an impact on any of those. So it was time for me to go and do what was really an unrealized dream.
Certain observers of the software industry and of the internet, et cetera, have long been concerned about the issue of privacy and its impact. But it seems, strikes me, Elizabeth, that lately that role in the whole political discourse and life of a country or indeed around the world is really in sharp focus today.
It is. There's a lot of work being done around this idea of the echo chamber, and that's that you can, because of your pre-existing beliefs and understandings of the world, you connect through social media and through the different sites on the internet to people who believe what you already believe. And through that system, your existing belief system is augmented and cemented in such a way as to contribute to the polarization of our society, not just ours, but you can see it happening across the world as well.
Now, your time to study political geography is a heady time, because not only the Scottish referendum, but there was the whole issue of Brexit that I'm sure that you watched and thought about a great deal. Would that be right?
That would be right. And in fact, there's a tie right back to the recall, because essentially the recall is a referendum. It's a referendum on the current governor of Alaska. The referendum in Scotland was a referendum on whether to stay or leave the EU. And in many ways, it was fought on the basis of stability. People who said, let's remain in the UK, were like, this is better, we're part of the EU. The EU doesn't promise that we get to stay if we leave the United Kingdom. So, you know, the best course of action, the safest thing to do, is to stay in the Union. And guess what? Turns out it wasn't so much. And Brexit was another referendum. And the problem with referendums is a yes, no on very complicated issues. And again, back to the podcast, because it may seem a simple issue to say yes or no to the governor, but it isn't actually. There's a lot of different elements to that discussion, and of course, a lot of different points of view. So understanding what the impact is and why it's important to recall is an element of a referendum. So yeah, Brexit, it's a really sad time, actually, for people in the UK. It's divided families, it's divided communities, it's divided different aspects of the country. And some of the research done recently on Brexit is really fascinating, because the assumption was, because, for example, Wales voted, it looked like overwhelmingly, to leave the EU, that the Welsh were opposed to the EU, but it turns out it was English settlers, retirees in the borderlands of Wales, who tipped that vote to leave.
Well, and that's ironic in a sense, because oftentimes these movements, for example, Brexit and certain other nationalistic movements, are really identified of us against them, and we have to pull in the wagons and sort of circle things around and just protect our piece of turf.
There's this term called othering. So it's the actual conscious, deliberate attempt to set up a situation in which people are seeing themselves as in opposition to others, or other people as some kind of threat. And that's very much part of the really what the world's facing.
The historian Yuval Noah Harari wrote a book called Sapiens, and his contention was, we have developed so much as a species that problems that previously, political and economic and environmental problems that originally could be solved on the local or national level, are now beyond that, and that we really do have to in some way encompass cooperative behavior on the political scale if we're going to meaningfully address that. What's your perspective, having studied this and got your doctorate in it?
It's very hard to disagree with him, and I think he's not wrong. He ties into something. He's a historian, I'm a geographer, but scale is something that we hold in common, and that idea of where things can be solved. I guess I differ a little bit with him in that I think the solutions have to come at both micro and macro scales. Because if we're talking about, for example, democracy as a way of solving governance, it seems to me that it works best at smaller scales. And I tend to use Iceland as an example. It's not perfect as a country by any means. But if you look at its reaction to the financial crisis, to the privatization of banks that then failed, and the public, the civic response to a demand to pay back through taxation to all of the investors who invested. Basically, Icelanders said no and fired the government and hired a new one. And I thought they could do that essentially because of the size of the country, which isn't too far in terms of population from the state of Alaska.
And we often kind of want to geopolitically link ourselves with the polar nations. And indeed, because of climate change, many of the impacts of climate changing are felt disproportionately strongly in the high latitudes.
That's right. And I think we're linked in so many different ways. There's certainly some economic links. There's a clear, as you say, a geographical link. And I think there's a cultural link. I got to meet some people and get to know them quite well through my earlier work in software in Iceland. And we clicked immediately, and we sort of decided that's because we're both essentially northern peoples. And, you know, people from the north have an attitude towards one another that has to do with stopping and helping if somebody is stuck on the side of the road because you're either remote or it's cold outside. But basically, you're part of a community.
So I'm wondering, what can the average person do? Obviously, you're trained now to analyze and think about these issues. Are there things that you would tell the listener to start thinking and contributing in creative ways to resolving the problems and the polarization? And can you do that in 30 seconds there?
That's a pretty big question. But what I think everybody can do is question their own assumptions, do a bit of research, come to a conclusion and share that conclusion with other people. You don't have to be a PhD, you don't have to be a master's student to do that. You just need to take a little bit of time and try to understand the facts for yourself. Kind of back to that discussion we had about the bubble. You know, can you separate yourself from the bubble a little bit? Because we all come with a bias. We all have what my field calls positionality. I am who I am. I am, you know, a white woman born in Alaska of a certain age, a university brat. That's part of who I am, and I can't not be that, but I can recognize that that's where I come from when I think about things. So sort of trying as much as you can to step outside of where you are and question your assumptions and do some research and think things through for yourself. I have a lot of respect for people like Dermot Cole. I read what he writes with a certain seriousness, but I also check out his facts and think about other arguments about how his argument may or may not be true or may not hold water for me personally. But then I think you've got to take that thinking and outside yourself and share it with other people.
I recently had the opportunity to talk with Catherine Hayhoe, who is a climate scientist. She's also an evangelical Christian. And one of her recommendations, the three top things to engage in to make a difference, was a talk about it, which your podcast is addressing. Secondly, is join groups that amplify your voice and vote was the third thing. Do you kind of agree with those points?
Yeah, I do. The sharing, amplify your voice, there's different modes of doing that. For example, when a certain person was elected president and I wasn't so happy about that, my first reaction was to up my donations. So I'd already joined, I was a member of many of those groups, but I sat back and I looked and I did my research to figure out who had a crackerjack legal team, because it seemed obvious that a lot of the fights ahead were going to be fought in the courts, in the judicial system, and I gave my money to those who already knew how to fight that kind of fight. So I think there are different ways of joining.
What's ahead for Elizabeth now with the podcast? Obviously, you were talking about there's a gap between each of the mileposts that go forward, and right now I'm guessing it's going to be a legal wrangle.
It would be very nice if the lieutenant governor would accept the proposition, but we think he probably won't, and there will be a legal fight. So yeah, that will take some time, and that kind of goes back to keeping the momentum going and just reminding people this is not over. And not only that, he walked back some of his budget cuts, but were he to survive the recall, he'd be pretty much free to do anything, wouldn't he? So I think we have to keep the danger top of mind. Mm-hmm. So I have other things going on in my life. I did before this started, and I will continue to do so. I'm writing a book based on my PhD. I'm writing some articles. I've become very interested in the relationship between geography and science. So I've got some projects that I'm working on.
Elizabeth Alexander, I can't thank you enough for sitting down and talking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Links to Elizabeth Alexander and her podcast are on the Northern Soundings website. She'll also be talking about the podcast at the monthly Fahrenkamp Luncheon in Fairbanks this December. That's it for this edition of Northern Soundings. I hope you'll join me next time as I explore the genetics of the Ice Age. See you then.